So I want to continue today to offer some context and elaboration of what Sayadaw was sharing in his previous talks at the beginning of this retreat. And by way of context, I want to begin by telling very briefly the framing story of this Metta Sutta that we chant every night, or almost every night. It could be told in great detail, but I'll tell it briefly. As the story goes, at the time of the rainy season, when the monks are by their training precepts required to stay in one place, right before the rainy season at one point, the Buddha was approached by a group of 100 monks who came to him. They paid their respects. They asked his permission to go practice, which was offered. And then they left, walking by stages to the foothills of the Himalaya. And they found a delightful forest grove with a stream and a nearby village where they could go for alms. And the villagers were really, really happy to see the monks there because this was kind of the outland, a place where bhikkhus never went. And so the villagers were very pleased and said, "We'll support all of you for the duration of your retreat." They helped build little kutis in the forest, and the monks settled in and began to practice vipassana. The other beings who lived in this forest, the unseen beings, the tree devas, were initially also really very pleased the bhikkhus had arrived, but very shortly it became clear that they were sticking around for longer than a few days. And these tree devas had come down from the trees where they lived out of respect for the monks. And then when it became clear that they couldn't go home again, they thought, oh, okay. You know how it is when guests stay on too long. So, now what do we do? So they began to haunt the bhikkhus with horrible sounds, horrible smells, horrible visions. And the monks were practicing in silence, as you are doing. They weren't communicating with each other. And they were getting more and more kind of pale and wan and, it wasn't going well, let's put it that way. So after a while, after they met on the new moon and full moon to chant together the training rules, they looked around at each other and said, when we got here, you were all looking really healthy, and now, And so each one told the story of what had been happening to them. And they all realized, we can't stay here. We're all too freaked out by this. So they broke Vasa, they broke the rains retreat, and walked back to where the Buddha was. A long walk, wasn't a short walk. And they got there, and the Buddha said, "What are you guys doing here? You're not supposed to be here. Go back there." They said, no, we're not going back there. Please don't make us go back there. And so the Buddha then said, "Well, what's going on?" And they told him. And at that point, then the Buddha offered this teaching. This is what's done by one skilled in what's good, who knows the path of peace, and so on. And when he finished his teaching, this Metta Sutta, he instructed them to go back, continue to practice, but also pervade the forest and all around with metta, all beings. And he said, "This is your practice and your protection." So off they went, back to the forest. and began the practice again, but also began to pervade in all quarters this metta. And it has to be said, these were monks who were quite skilled in the practice already, obviously. And very shortly after that, the devas really began to be very happy they were there, helping them, serving them. And of course, the story has a happy ending. Everybody was enlightened in the end. So, the Buddha offered this teaching explicitly as an antidote to terror, to fear. And of course, we're all familiar with this state. At least some gradient of it, whether it's just background anxiety or outright panic. Fear is a universal human experience. And yet it's a state that we avoid at all costs. So in our everyday lives, we deal with it in many ways, ranging from complete avoidance to, you know, trying to fix, to being addicted to information. Maybe if we know enough, maybe we'll be able to, you know, avoid feeling this. So perhaps we see problems in the world or our own problems, and we endlessly question or do research. How did we get there? Where is it going? We look at studies. We look at polls. We look at numbers and trends, and we try to nail everything down. That's one extreme. Or maybe we go to the other extreme and we just retreat from the grit of the world as much as possible and avoid engaging this relative human plane, this physical existence, by seeking comfort in higher truths. Oh, it's all conventional. It's all anicca, we might say to ourselves, trying to pretend, oh well, it's all anicca, doesn't matter. And many of us fall between these two extremes. And really, our task is to figure out how to stay connected with the world and our lives without getting overwhelmed, freaked out, drowning in fear. In the Dhammapada, the Buddha said, "To many places, people, beings withdraw to escape from fear, to mountains, forests, parklands, and gardens, sacred places as well. But none of these places offer true refuge. None of them can free us from fear." You can't run away. Oh. But this antidote to fear that he offers, of course, was finding access to that true refuge, that true inner refuge, by training and purifying the heart and mind through meditation, through ethical conduct. So we take this on as practice. Because as Pema Chodron wisely says, and very pithily says, there's wisdom in no escape. You can't run away. And ultimately, practice gives us that place of inner safety, being balanced in the here and now, connected, even if it's scary. The paradox and the irony being, of course, that this practice, quote unquote, works only to the extent that we can come to grips inside with the very things we want to be free of in the first place. So if we want to be free from fear, we have to face fear and know it as it is. If we want to be free from anger, we have to face anger and know it as it is. If we want to be free from greed or any other unwholesome mind state, we have to face greed and know it as it is. Through the entire range of painful human experience. So here we are with this. Fear in particular is challenging. It manifests as either flight, running away, removing ourselves from whatever is frightening, or fight, which is striking out against it. And if fear is really strong, everything is screaming really viscerally, get me out of here, you know. Even if there's no real or present danger, it can feel very real and very present. And it's very hard not to drown in that. And because fear is extremely difficult to simply rest with and to feel, it's often masked or accompanied by a whole suite of other challenging states that lie on top of it, that we're often more in touch with. Anger, judgment, resentment, which is a combination of greed and anger, jealousy and envy, where there's negativity, but the greed is actually quite predominant. Even grief is a form of negativity, where there's strong attachment and yet the fear of how am I going to be without this? So there are all these other states, and often underlying them is some form of fear. And all together, they together count as dosa in Pali, which one translation is ill will or aversion. A dosa covers a lot of ground. So there's fear, and then these other states, anger, for example, judgment. And it's so interesting to look at judgment and anger. Look it in the face. And often we see, right beneath the surface of that, this spark of fear or anxiety. I remember the first time I really connected with this. I was driving. I was still a layperson. I was driving a car that did not belong to me. It belonged to the retreat center where I worked. And I was driving through the little town near the retreat center, and somebody cut right in front of me. I mean, it was a very narrow miss. We nearly collided. And my first response was to yell out the window, lean on the horn, and yell something unprintable. But because of the practice, I noticed that right under that was this, oh my God, I nearly crashed the car. So often when there's a flash of anger, right under that, there's this wobbliness of fear or anxiety. And it's hard to see because we are so habituated, especially men, to be honest, very habituated to strike out and to not give in to fear anyway, not to really connect with it. And commonly, of course, there's often a lot of judgment in that anger, together with the raw anger. So what I yelled out the window is some judging remark about the person's intelligence. And you know, where we take a stance, who's right, who's wrong, we point the finger at the other person. And sometimes it might not be something like that example. Maybe they're just a little different than us. Maybe they do things differently. But still, there's this anger that comes from some spark of fear. And we go, that person. And examples from retreat are so common. You can actually, from the outside looking in, you can actually observe these things happening. For example, when there's a mix of people doing metta and vipassana practice, some people are going really, really slowly, and some people are not. Both are fine in the context of whatever practice they're doing. But when people like this interact in a meal queue, it can be very interesting. The slow people are like going really, really slowly. And when they encounter somebody going faster, they go even slower, as if to say, well, you should be going slower. Meanwhile, the person who's going faster, you know, pushes up against the person going slower, like, hurry up already, what's your problem? And there's no words spoken. And I know from my own practice, I know when I'm really slowed down and other people aren't, I can think, oh, those fast people, they're just not really practicing, they're just careless, slackers, you know? Or if I'm going more quickly, I might look at the slow people and go, oh God, they're so obsessive. What's their problem? Why don't they loosen up? The mind plays these tricks on us. But under all of that, there can be this little anxiety. It's like, maybe I'm not doing it right. Maybe they're right. Maybe I'm wrong. Or something. You know? But there is this finger pointing, this judging. And it's so easy to point the finger at somebody else's faults, isn't it? Coming from this place of real, I mean, there's a tender place of vulnerability that this springs from. But it's very easy to go, that person, bad, me, good. This is very human and universal. Borrowing from another tradition, the Christian tradition, Jesus's advice is really wonderful here. Why do you see the splinter that's in your brother's eye, but don't notice the log that's in your own eye? First, take the log out of your own eye, and then you will see clearly enough to take the splinter out of your brother's eye. We don't like this. But really, in the practice, it's always to look at ourselves, to see, well, what's going on in here, not what's going on out there. And take care of it in here. Take care of if there's judgment, if there's anger, if there's anxiety and fear, that's your practice. Not how fast or slow somebody's going, not how much noise they're making. This is a challenge. So there's anger and judgment that can overlie fear. There's also sometimes if we rest there, there can be resentment. And if we ignore that log in our own eye, and cling to anger about something that someone did, and carefully nurture that anger. We get this resentment thing, which is an emotional response that lasts over time, one that can come with hurt, pride, and all sorts of assumptions about somebody else's motives. And, you know, in the world, resentment often comes when there is jealousy, envy. Somebody got something that we think we deserve. And we don't think they deserve it. And why doesn't the world see how wrong this is? And so if we nurture this carefully and keep coming back to it, this can be such poison. And we don't even see underneath it that quivering of anxiety. It's like, what if I don't get what I need? What if I'm a failure? What if, fill in the blank. We all have our what ifs that cause anxiety and fear. And in this situation, even though retaliation and revenge might seem to be, at least initially, a pleasant thought, or maybe we act it out and maybe it feels perversely pleasant, when resentment, anger, judgment become obsessive, they become poisons. They're already poisons, but they really become potent poisons that destroy our heart. They don't do anything to the person they're directed at, but they corrode us from the inside. And so if we have these repetitive revenge fantasies, or maybe we act them out, we're actually increasing our own torment, our own suffering. And it can turn us from being a person to whom something has simply happened into an aggressor. So fear, anger, judgment, resentment, revenge. Why we do these things, the, you know, psychological explanation, is actually much less interesting than why we have such a hard time putting them aside. And often that boils down to, and this is kind of yucky when I have felt it, it's like, ugh. But often it comes down to identity and self-pity. And these two things are traps that keep us stuck in these mind states. Because there's a kind of ego gratification that comes with self-righteous anger, with envy, with resentment. And we become addicted to that. And then there can be, oh, poor me, you know, the story of how wronged I've been my whole life, or then. And it might be, you know, 60 years ago then. But we keep chewing on this. We can't help it. In this kind of context, I really love Stephen Mitchell's telling of the myth of Sisyphus. As you know, Sisyphus was the Greek a Greek myth about this being who was doomed for all eternity to roll this enormous rock up a hill, but never quite making it to the top. And then it would roll down and he'd have to go down and push it up again. And it's often used as a way of articulating the pointlessness of life. But actually, I think the deeper meaning is with regard to these inner states that we keep pushing uphill. So here's how he puts this. He says, "We tend to think of Sisyphus as a tragic hero, condemned by the gods to shoulder his rock sweatily up the mountain and again up the mountain forever." The truth is that Sisyphus is in love with his rock. He cherishes every roughness and every ounce of it. He talks to it, sings to it. He even dreams of it as he sleepwalks upward. Life is unimaginable without it, looming always above him like a huge gray moon. He doesn't realize that at every and any moment he can just step aside, let the rock hurtle to the bottom, and go home. The tragedy is the inertia of the mind. I don't know if you can relate to that, but I certainly can. We all have these rocks. And we find ourselves pushing that darn rock up that darn hill again. There is this inertia of the heart that keeps chewing on fear, anger, resentment, judgment, self-judgment. But the Buddha held out this promise to us that ultimately fear and the rest of these unwholesome mind states are a choice. And metta is a choice. And by doing the practice, as you are doing, you are feeding that choice. You are choosing metta again and again and again and again, no matter what comes up. This is the habit that the practice cultivates, this habit of stepping aside and going home to the metta. And there, of course, is the other metaphor of feeding and starving. Many of you, I'm sure, are familiar with the story from the American Indian tradition of the two wolves, where a grandfather is speaking to his grandson and he says, "A fight is going on inside me. It's a terrible fight, and it's between two wolves. One is evil. He is anger, envy, sorrow, regret, greed, arrogance, self-pity, guilt, resentment, and so on. The other is good. He is joy, peace, love, hope, serenity, humility, kindness, benevolence, empathy, generosity, truth, compassion, and faith. The same fight is going on inside you and inside every person, too." The grandson thought for a moment and said, "Well, which one wins?" And the grandfather says, "The one I feed." So practically, how to work with these states is knowing what feeds and what starves them. And there are two ways to feed dark states. We feed them with avoidance, and we feed them with indulgence. And it's hard to know sometimes. It's hard to discern the balanced place between these two in the practice. And this is so much a part of the art of the practice. Because the challenge is to relinquish this obsession with our rocks, whatever that rock happens to be, without resisting it. And to surrender to the fact that it is there in the first place without chewing on it or obsessing over it or identifying with it. Here in the context of the metta practice, the instruction, of course, is simply acknowledge that rock, whatever it happens to be. Set it aside and keep inclining the heart to metta. To just let it be there without adding anything extra. Without beating yourself up about the irrationality of perhaps there's fear. And you think, this is stupid, I shouldn't be afraid of this. But without adding that judgment. Without trying to process it or understand it psychologically. There's a place for that, but it isn't here. So we just let it be there. No need to focus on it as we do in other practices. Just let it all rest in that big field of metta. Keep repeating the phrase. And sometimes I really love to add, no matter what, at the end of that. Or anyway, may I be peaceful and at ease, anyway. Letting that anyway be very kind, be very gentle. And with fear, particularly if that is there, taking a lot of care to be gentle, to be really gentle, and not to try to push through that in any way, not trying to transcend it or get over it or get around it or past it. Not trying to just get used to it. I had a very difficult time in the practice that came from that. I was experiencing quite strong fear in my Vipassana practice, really, really profound fear. And I acknowledged it, I thought, kindly. But I was pretending to myself, out of an identity of wanting to be a good yogi, oh, it's just fear. That's okay. I can be with that. And then I kept attending to what was causing the fear to arise and denying that it was important. And that denial is what creates the trouble. And I pushed myself into a very dark corner by doing that. I learned a lot. If there's fear, not to deny the power of it, and to back off if you have to do vipassana if you have to, really rest in what Ajahn Brahm calls kindfulness, letting that vipassana, being very gentle, very kind, open it up, not to focus in on it by way of trying to get through it, just breathing in it. Keep radiating the metta. Anyway. And please remember with all these difficult mind states fear and the rest. That the proximate cause of metta is seeing the goodness in beings, in ourselves or in whomever we're cultivating the metta for. So finding where you can see goodness and inclining the mind there. In yourself, if that's where you're radiating metta, or in another. Acknowledging the fear or anger, resentment, envy, self-pity, whatever it is. And in spite of that, anyway, may I be at ease, may you be at ease. So notice that goodness and consciously incline the heart there again and again and again with a lot of kindness and a lot of patience. No matter what the old habits are asking you to do. Because those old stories will sing their song. Conditioning doesn't get erased when we do the practice. It's not that it will never come up again. At first, strongly, and then as the practice goes on, more and more and more subtly. So that we might not even be aware these states are there, if they are. But one of the wonderful things about metta is that it invites forgiveness for ourselves and for others. And it's this forgiveness that integrates the metta and brings it into the entirety of our life. And the power of this metta practice is it deals with the real stuff of our life. It enters that door of the Dhamma through our stories, through our relationships. The old grudges, hurts, judgments, fears, longings, all of that stuff. These rocks that we push around. And forgiveness is something I want to talk a little bit about because it's really an essential aspect of this metta practice. Because with forgiveness, we're giving up whatever it is that we maintain when we're pushing those rocks around. We're giving up something in order to stop maintaining these cycles of anger, of judgment, of fear, of hatred. So forgiveness is really that sense of surrender. And maybe it means giving up whatever we feel is our justified right to retaliate, to judge. Maybe we have to give up moral indignation. We certainly have to give up grievances, grudges, resentments, all these things that we've held on to and identified with. And it helps, if this is happening, it helps to admit to ourselves that we really do not want to do this at the beginning. Because there is that strong identification. And we don't want to give that up. Whether it's being identified with being a victim or being a villain. You know, it might be really strong self-judgment. I'm so bad. Or, this is what happened to me. You know, one side of that coin or the other can be the place where identity lands. So if we're a victim, we're clinging to this wanting to take revenge, wanting the whole world to see what a bad person they are. And if it's something we've done, ooh, there can be this really toxic shame. And particularly in the West, this can be something that rests under a lot of things, unknown and unacknowledged. And this all begins to unfold and open out with forgiveness when we start to recognize that it's not just me, not just us. We're all in the same boat as human beings, this common humanity of being flawed, of making mistakes, of not being perfect. It includes us all. So forgiveness is supported by deeply, deeply being realistic about ourselves and about others, understanding human nature. And I really so appreciate in the early texts the stories of the Buddha, because he wasn't some airy-fairy kind of sweet-talking guru. He could be so forceful and direct. And he was such a realist who understood how people can be. Not always nice. And so he understood the challenge of forgiveness, the challenges of metta, in the face of our potential for harmful speech and harmful actions. While, of course, understanding the power of not feeding those harmful tendencies. So here, for example, is what he says in the Majjhima Nikaya, in the sutta called the Simile of the Saw. Bhikkhus, monks, even if bandits were to sever you savagely, limb by limb, with a two-handled saw, he who gave rise to a mind of hatred towards them would not be carrying out my teaching. Herein, bhikkhus, you should train thus. Our minds will become unaffected. We shall utter no evil words. We shall abide compassionate for their welfare, with a mind of loving kindness, without inner hate. We shall abide pervading them with a mind imbued with this loving kindness, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility and without ill will. That is how you should train, bhikkhus. Whoa. I don't know about you, but maybe we're not there yet. But even if somebody savagely dismembers you, never mind, you know, that they say something about you to someone else, you know, that's minor. This is where this practice heads. And he's not saying everybody's nice. No, he said, oh yeah, somebody might come along and saw your arms off. But if that gives rise to hatred, then you are not carrying out my teachings. This is should not give rise to judgment towards yourself, but to inspiration. This is where this goes. Whoa. This is where this goes. It's profound. And that kind of forgiveness grows from where we are now, right here. That inability to do that. Out of a willingness to transform that impulse for revenge, for hatred, for judgment, into something bigger and more powerful. That almost miraculous quality to forgive and connect with that heart of metta. And in the real world, this sort of thing happens. I took a deep dive into quite a deep rabbit hole on the internet, looking at forgiveness stories, and there's so many of them out there. People forgiving murderers, people forgiving drunk drivers that killed their kids, people forgiving others who perpetuated genocide. All sorts of stories of human capacity right here today in this world for forgiveness. One that so touched me speaks to the power of forgiveness to transform not only the forgiver, but the person who is forgiven. It goes both ways, and metta goes both ways like this. It was a book from Life After Hate, written by a young man in America named Arno Michaelis. And Arno had been, in his youth, because of conditions, a neo-Nazi, and a really predominant one. And he'd gotten on one of his fingers a swastika tattoo. And one day he went to McDonald's where he was living off the smell of an oily rag, basically. He didn't have a lot of money, so he would eat at McDonald's. And he went in there, and the lady who was serving him happened to be black, an African-American woman, who looked at his new tattoo and looked him straight in the eye and said, "Son, I know you're bigger than that. I know you're better than that." And he said he grabbed his food and he ran away, and he never went back into that McDonald's again. But a seed was planted. And eventually, it led him out into separating himself from this indoctrination. And really now, his whole life's work is to teach people about the dangers of hatred. He's completely emerged from this. So this is a quote from how he relates to forgiveness. He says, "Forgiveness is a sublime example of humanity that I explore at every opportunity, because it was the unconditional forgiveness that I was given by people who I once claimed to hate that demonstrated the way from there to here." So you see how with forgiveness, as with metta, when we plant that seed, we don't know what will grow. We don't know how it will affect the world, ourselves. We keep planting that. So one last thing, though, to say about forgiveness is that don't demand it of yourself. It ceases to be beneficial when it's a kind of a prescription that you should do. To force ourselves or to force somebody else who's in pain to forgive. It's brutal. Forgiveness only emerges when we give it space, when we dive into what we are feeling with that willingness to feel it, not to feed it. And it's challenging because it can be an isolating place in our society to forgive. Society sometimes seems to want us to hate each other. So if something happened to you and you forgive, people will say, oh, how can you forgive that? They're so wrong. Do it anyway, if you can. And aim in that direction if you're not quite ready to go there. That's all you need to do. Feeding the wolf, that is the light wolf, not the dark one, to do that courageous thing, which is to cultivate metta anyway. So fear, anger, resentment, envy, jealousy, judgment. All these difficult states that metta is the antidote to, all these poisons that metta is the antidote to, and the forgiveness that comes with and supports the metta. It's like yin and yang. It's these very states that open the heart to the boundlessness of that metta. And the willingness to just keep going that allows that. When there's metta, there's patience. When there's patience, there's metta. And my preceptor and teacher Upandita used to say, the road to Nibbana is paved with patience. So this is a great support, to be patient with conditions, to be patient with yourself, even if there's fear, even if there's anger. And let this be the doorway in to that metta. Anyway, so I want to close with the verses from the Dhammapada. He abused me, he struck me, he overpowered me, he robbed me. For those who dwell on such thoughts, hatred never ceases. He abused me, he struck me, he overpowered me, he robbed me. For those who do not dwell on those thoughts, hatred ceases. Hatred never ceases by hatred, but by love alone. This is an eternal law. Hatred never ceases by hatred, but by love alone. This is an eternal law. So thank you for your kind attention. May you always dwell in this place of metta and forgiveness. Thank you for your kind attention.